I'm Marty Moscoe-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. Yesterday, disgraced Philadelphia District Attorney Seth Williams was led out of a federal courtroom in handcuffs. He had pled guilty to one count of bribery in the middle of his corruption trial, where he faced multiple charges. The judge said that Williams had betrayed and sold his office and that he was appalled by the evidence he had heard. Williams could face a maximum of 5 years in prison. WHYY's Bobby Allen covered this trial, and he joins us on Radio Times to talk about the evidence, the testimony against Seth Williams. And Bobby, you were last on the show talking about the Cosby trial. Nice to have you back with us on Radio
Times. Thanks for having me, Marty.
You're welcome. And to our listeners, especially if you want to call in specifically about this trial and this issue, that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. We have three discrete segments in this hour of Radio Times. Bobby, how big a surprise that Seth Williams pled guilty yesterday?
It was quite astonishing. Everyone went into the courtroom yesterday expecting to hear the eighth day of testimony in the prosecution's case against Seth Williams, and all the reporters came in, and we noticed that the jury wasn't in the jury box, that the witness wasn't on the witness stand, the judge wasn't in the room, and instead the prosecution and defense lawyers were confabbing, they were exchanging papers, they were signing papers, they would come in and out of the hallway, and we all thought, what's going on? And then the judge walked out, and he delivered the really surprising news that in the middle of his corruption trial, Seth Williams has pled guilty, and the trial was then over.
Did Seth Williams say anything yesterday?
He made a few comments. When the judge said, did anyone force you to take this plea deal? He said no. He said, do you have any other comments for the court? And he said, Your Honor, I'm sorry for all this trouble.
And where is he? He was led out of the room in handcuffs.
Yeah,
that must have been pretty dramatic moment.
It really was. So after the judge announced that Seth Williams was pleading to one bribery count, now he was charged with 29. So some people say this was a pretty good deal for him. 28 other counts he will not be convicted of. This one bribery charge has the maximum punishment of 5 years in prison, and he will be sentenced in October. Now typically in a white collar case like this, the defendant would leave and, 3-4 months later come back to court to be sentenced. But immediately the judge held a detention hearing to determine whether Seth Williams was a flight risk.
Wow.
And his defense attorney said, look, he has no money. He has maybe $200 in his checking account. He's not going to go anywhere. He's a prominent guy. A lot of people have their eye on Seth Williams. He's absolutely not a flight risk. And the judge, who has been pretty stern throughout this trial, said, you know what? I do not believe Seth Williams. I am demanding that the U.S. Marshals put him in handcuffs, Seth Williams was put in handcuffs and led out of the courtroom and taken to, actually a stone's throw away from WHYY, the federal detention center at 7th and Arch, where he will stay in a jail cell until his October sentencing hearing. That was a very, very stunning thing to witness.
As you said, there were 29 charges against him. Is there a way to distill all that? What were the charges he was actually facing?
So the heart of this case has to do with public corruption and quid pro quo. The government says that Seth Williams took in gifts from wealthy business owners in the form of Caribbean vacations, fancy dinners, expensive accessories and expensive furniture in exchange for official acts. Basically that he sold the influence of the district attorney's office and abused his power after he accepted gifts. There's a few schemes that they laid out in detail. And in addition, he allegedly defrauded his political action committee by using campaign money for personal things like going to a fancy gym, and that he also took money from his mother's nursing home and used that on sort of fueling and paying for his extravagant lifestyle. And over the course of 7 days, the jurors heard pretty gripping testimony and at times really embarrassing testimony. They read dozens and dozens and dozens of text messages where some of the bribers used to refer to Seth as Little Sethy. They talked about him dressing up as Santa Claus. I mean, it was a pretty tough trial to watch because the material that was coming out just portrayed Seth Williams in a very, very, very unfortunate light.
How did all this get started? And it did involve one of these businessmen who did testify at this trial.
Yeah. So there's this guy, Muhammad Ali, not the boxer. Right. Instead, it's a guy from Bucks County, a businessman who made millions of dollars selling prepaid cell phone cards and energy drinks. Go figure. I don't know. He made lots of money off those two things. And he actually was using some of the money and sending it abroad. And the feds got involved at a certain point, and he was under investigation for money laundering. So that investigation was going on for a while, and eventually more than a dozen federal agents went to his Bucks County home in Feasterville, and they went over all of his everything he had in his office, through all of his cell phones, and they were probing deep. And the one thing that they noticed very quickly was he had exchanged many text messages with the sitting district attorney of Philadelphia, Seth Williams. And when they realized that tie between businessman Muhammad Ali and Seth Williams, the case that eventually went to trial got started. It all started with Muhammad Ali, that businessman originally from Jordan, but now lives in Bucks County.
And what did this businessman, Muhammad Ali, what did he get for all the money that he gave to Seth Williams and all the trips that Seth Williams took?
So the government said after showering him with Caribbean vacations, they had a video of Seth parasailing with Muhammad Ali in the Caribbean. I mean, Burberry, gifts, iPads, you name it. He got all of these. He was showering Seth Williams with gifts, and in return, he was getting help getting through airport screening. So Muhammad Ali would travel abroad a lot. And when he would come through, he kept having to endure these secondary airport screenings. And he thought it was...
Because he was Muslim?
He thought it was because he was Muslim. He thought he was being racially targeted when, in fact, he was under investigation for money laundering. He'd know that at the time. But his pal, Seth Williams, he said, hey, I'm sick of having to go... I have to endure these interrogations by Homeland Security every single time I go to the airport. Can you help me out with this? So Seth saw what he could do. He contacted some police officials. He had a Muhammad Ali had a police escort at one point. He contacted Congressman Bob Brady's office. He made several steps to try to remedy this airport hassle. And when officials realized that, no, this is not an example of racial profiling, this person is actually the suspected of money laundering. Then they realized that Seth might be in trouble.
Wow. Also, another businessman, Michael Weiss, the owner of Woody's, a well-known gay bar in Philadelphia. What was his testimony about?
Yes, he talked about, he gave 16, round-trip tickets to Seth Williams. He gave him this Jaguar from the 90s-era Jaguar and many other gifts. And Weiss was hoping to supposedly buy the influence of Seth Williams in exchange for becoming a special advisor in the district attorney's office, which included a official badge with the DA's office. And they read one.
That's what Weiss wanted?
Well, that's what Weiss got. Weiss said he gave the gifts to Seth Williams, not necessarily aiming for what he got in return, which was part of the defense strategy. They were trying to say, hey, there's not a clear line between the gifts and what was received. And that kind of broke down when the government pushed back against it and said, so, Mike Weiss, were you giving Seth Williams these gifts for influence? And he said, famously now, in part, kind of proved the government's case that, yes, he was plying, Mike Weiss was plying Seth Williams with gifts to get access to power. And at one point, Seth Williams texted Mike Weiss and said, have you flashed your badge yet recently? As a way of saying, hey, wink, wink, nudge, nudge, you gave me all those gifts, you now have the badge, go ahead and use it.
In these cases, you just wonder why people don't know that email and texts are essentially like sending a postcard through the mail.
Yeah, absolutely. Even after Seth Williams was indicted in March, he kept some of these text exchange going. They read text messages that he sent to some of his bribers, I guess alleged bribers now because he admitted to it, even after the indictment. So there was a long, paper trail, electric sort of text message and email trail between Seth and all these various people. And the government had a lot of electronic evidence.
In fact, we have email from Stu saying, will there be charges and or restitution against the people who paid the bribes? Do you know, Bobby, how they figure into this verdict?
Yes.
This plea, I should say.
So the restitution question is yet to be determined. We're going to learn a lot more come October during the sentencing phase of Seth Williams' criminal case. And he could face a fine up to $250,000.
Wow.
And there will be some restitution probably as a part of that, but that's still not yet determined. So wait to see on that.
An email from Bill says, why did they let him off on the other charges? He pled guilty to one out of these 29.
That's a good question. And the government lawyers told reporters after the hearing that this plea agreement to just plea to one of 29 counts was on the table way before the trial. And Seth Williams decided to decline it, and go to trial and see if he could beat all of them. Why did they? I don't really know. I'm not sure, but. Some people say it did work out well for Seth Williams because now the statutory max punishment for him is 5 years. Had the jury convicted him of all 29 and had those run consecutively, it could have been an effective life sentence. Now, in reality, it would have been much less than that, but he could have been facing many decades in federal prison had he been convicted of all 29.
We're focusing largely on the testimony of Michael Weiss and Muhammad Ali. Talk, Bobby, about how Seth Williams used money that was for his mother's nursing home care. How did that figure into this case?
Yeah, that was another scheme that prosecutors outlined to the jury, which is that he used money intended for his mother's nursing home care for some of his personal expenses. And, that was a pretty shocking revelation probably for the jurors to hear. I mean, stealing money from your own mother, it's hard to do something more offensive than that. So that was just one of a number of schemes of allegedly defrauding individuals, institutions, and the office of the district attorney. But the fact that it was his own mother, I think that packed a pretty visceral punch.
How about campaign expenses? What was that used by Seth Williams?
Yeah, one of the witnesses was a woman who used to control his PAC, Friends of Seth Williams, and she testified that he was constantly using donor money to go to the Union League of Philadelphia. He was using donor money to pay for the sporting club, the Bellevue Sporting Club, getting deep tissue facial massages and all of these other extravagant expenses. And at one point, he was using so much of the donor money that they couldn't even pay their bills. They couldn't pay their electricity bills. And she testified under oath that she sometimes wasn't getting paid because Seth was milking the donor money for personal expenses. So that was also a pretty key part of this trial.
The jury obviously didn't have a chance to render a verdict, and it's always risky, Bobby, to look at a jury or jurors and try to figure out what they are thinking. Did they give anything away? Were there any significant moments?
You know, it's hard to say sometimes what's going on in the jury's minds. You could only just kind of gauge their reactions. And the 10 women and 2 men who were the jurors in this case, some of them did react quite strongly to some of the testimony because, like I said, so much of it was so gripping. I mean, day after day after day, we were hearing intimate conversations that Seth Williams never thought would be publicly aired in court. Very embarrassing, very lurid details about his personal life and about his finances and about his connections to various business people. And seeing that testimony unreal in the courtroom to the jurors, I mean, you could see them. They were taken aback at times by some of it.
And who's running the DA's office now?
So right now, Kathy Martin, who is the first assistant in the district attorney's office, and she basically has been running the DA's office for some time now. And it's yet to be determined who is going to replace Seth Williams. A group of Philadelphia judges will make that determination, and that will run until January when Philadelphia voters go to the polls to choose the next district attorney in November.
Bobby Allen, thank you for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thanks, Marty.
You're welcome. WHYY reporter, and he covered the trial of former district attorney Seth Williams. Stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moscoen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. July 4th kicks off the summer season when most people take a vacation. Many in the Philadelphia area go down the shore, our way of saying go and enjoy the beaches of New Jersey. But it's a big country. What about a road trip? I've certainly had some good ones in my lifetime. We asked Larry Blyberg to give us some ideas. He writes for USA Today and Better Homes and Gardens. He's a 7-time winner of the Lowell Thomas Travel Journalism Award. He's former travel editor of the Dallas Morning News. And Larry Blyberg, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Well, it's great to be here.
And to our listeners, we are talking about road trips in this portion of Radio Times. Give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us with WHYY Radio Times with any questions that you might have or even stories that you'd like to tell. So, Larry, any road trips planned for this summer for you?
Well, I just wanted to say that this is the perfect time to get started on a road trip. AAA just came out with some information just a day or so ago that the nationwide average of a price of gas is going to be lower than it's been since 2005 for Independence Day. So, you know, it's almost cheaper to get on the road than to stay home. So I've already done a couple road trips this summer season. I did one across the South through Mississippi and did one down the coast as well. And then coming up, there's just so many other opportunities to so many places to go. And I guess it just you talked about people get into patterns.
Yes.
As you said, they go to the shore and they do the same thing. It's just maybe it's time to change things up. But a road trip is a little bit. It doesn't have to be the old school Thelma and Louise thing. You don't have to run off.
Well, certainly not with that ending. We don't want to go off the cliff.
But I find that for a road trip, it's great to have a mission of some sort or another. You just you want to get from point A to point B, but you know the fun happens along the way. It isn't getting to point B necessarily. That's just an excuse. So whatever you're into, let's say you're into Civil War history or quilting or baseball or barbecue, find some great stops along the way and meander. You know, it's not about getting there most quickly. It's having the fun along the way.
Well, you know, it's interesting. Yeah, you use the word meander. And I think sometimes with GPS and Google Maps, you know, we see where we're supposed to go and we aim our car and we get there. And there is a kind of joy, sometimes an anxiety of getting lost. Sometimes it's just fun to take that back road and see where it takes you.
Oh, of course. And in a strange way, GPS gives you freedom to get lost. I mean, I found that, it's hard to ignore that voice saying, you know, rerouting or whatever, but we all know that voice. But that means you can get lost. You can take that third turn and go down that highway and see where it goes. And eventually, you're going to be able to find your way back. And so that means you have a tether, so to speak, and you can try it out. And as I said about a mission, you really do want to be looking for something, because otherwise it's just transportation. You might as well be in the, you know, be in a plane.
Well, I also think when you get slightly lost or take some of those back roads or get off the main roads, you're going to find some cool little lunch joint that you're never going to find on, you know, I-95, for instance.
Exactly. I mean, you'll be astonished and saddened how you know the exact menu or you know, any McDonald's or anything else, or you can walk into a Target, whether it be in Philadelphia or in Los Angeles, and you know exactly where the contact lens solution is. I mean, it's just in some ways you haven't left home at all, and that's why you really need to get off and see other things. Another new sort of aspect of the road trip is, and people might have mixed feelings about it, this peer me through, is social media. I mean, I know the whole idea of getting on the road and taking a vacation is disconnecting, and Lord knows we need to do that. But with social media, well, let's put it this way. My cousin just drove from Boston to Los Angeles. I mean, talk about a road trip.
Yeah.
That's the ultimate, right?
Yeah.
With his daughter. He's driving his daughter, I think, to her first job out of college. And he was tweeting all the way and Facebooking all the way, and it was so much fun to join him and to give him a hard time when he just, you know, he said, do I even want to bother with Mount Rushmore? You know, it's just a bunch of dead white guys. I'm going, David, come on, you know, it's Mount Rushmore. You know, check out Crazy Horse too, but, you know, you got to do – so it was so much fun to join. It was no longer you know, just two people in the car. It was this whole community were joining him, and you pick up great suggestions. Crowdsourcing is a fancy way to say, you know, I was there and there's this incredible place where you can get a peach pie, but just, you know, go down in the state route 52. And it's so I think you want to limit your time on social media because you're there to connect with each other and to the environment. But it can really enhance the trip, too, if you, you know, kind of do it wisely.
Well, let me get
does that sound like.
No, that sounds fun. I mean, I think social media, especially with travel, is you both get to disconnect but also stay connected, at least to your friends and family through social media. Let me get Will from, looks like Wayne, Pennsylvania, to join our conversation. Hi, Will. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, you're right. It is Wayne. I figured it'd be sort of relevant for this conversation. Back in 2009, I did a bit of a summer vacation where I hitchhike across the country.
Oh, wow.
I went from here in Philadelphia to Hibbing, Minnesota, sort of walking and hitchhiking. I went up across sort of northwest up through Pennsylvania, went to Hershey, went through State College, went up through Erie, crossed Lake Erie, up Michigan, across Lake Michigan, through into Minnesota. And I had, it was an experience. You mentioned little out of the way places. I found that if you have a very large backpack on your bag and walk into a most diners and say, look, I'm hitchhiking cross country. I'm trying to save as much money as possible. Would I be able to, you know, do a little work in the kitchen to get a burger or something? They'd usually just give me a burger.
Oh, that's great. Good for you, Will. That's
wow.
That's terrific. And I was actually thinking of John Waters also hitchhiked across the country. He was a guest on the show a couple of years ago talking about his adventures. Will, I appreciate your call to Radio Times. Let me give Larry a chance to respond to that. Larry, have you ever done some major hitchhiking like that?
Oh, my goodness. I'm kind of ashamed. I think once I had a backpack, I was doing, it was just a short hike in Virginia, so I had to sort of hitchhike back to where the car was. That's hardcore. I mean, old school too. I think there's much more of a concern about it, a safety concern. That's back to Jack Kerouac and On the Road. And there's really no better way to see the world than from, that's a road trip. You're on the road, but to see it from 2 feet. I don't think that's for all of our listeners. I don't know if I'd be happy if my kid was doing it, but there'd be some great tales to tell afterwards.
Absolutely.
And that's part of what the whole story is.
Well, thanks for the call to Radio Times. You can call as well. And again, that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. In this portion of Radio Times, we are talking about road trips in and across America with our guest, Larry Bleiberg. Let me read a tweet from Matthew. He says, any tips for road trips with toddlers? I was on an avid road trip in my 20s and 30s, and now I'm intimidated by the tantrums or potential tantrums. Any suggestions, Larry, for families on the road?
Oh, my Lord. I've been there. Well, I'll go back to that famous columnist, Irma Bombeck, who said there are two types of travel: first class and with children. So it's a whole different ball game, but it's lots of fun. You just need to, the key thing is that you're going to have to change your pacing. You're not going to be able to do 10, 12 hours a day and just, say, well, shoot for the state line. You got to pretty much let the littlest passenger in the car set your pace. But you know what? That's fine. Once you adjust to that, you really do can settle into it. And I found traveling with my son when he was little, it really opened doors in so many ways, because anybody will relate to a kid, a little kid, and strangers, it starts conversations. And I would find, and this was much before too much GPS, but I would find playgrounds, because we would pull off the interstate and come to a little town, and my son needed to get his shakes out, so we would find a playground somewhere and we'd talk to local parents. And and then you have an excuse to go to those tacky roadside attractions, which, as a
they're great, though.
Mature adult. Yeah. Oh, gosh, they're my favorites. But as a mature adult, you go, there's no reason to pay, to go to Snake World. But, when you got a 5-year-old, you have to go to Snake World.
It's all about Snake World, isn't it?
Yeah. When you see the billboards 100 miles away, you're going to be hearing a lot about it, whether you go or not. So I just think it's really changing expectations and a little bit of the style that you travel. But, I think what I tell people is, when you think back about your family memories growing up, for the most part, what stands out to you? I mean, they're moments of the memories that people have are the trips that they took with their family, their vacations. Those are the two or three, when you're talking the top 10 memories of childhood, they're vacations that are in there. And this is precious time, and it's so much more about being together, having good experiences, bad experiences. You still get a great story out of it in memories. I'm not telling you to go look for bad ones, but
Well, they will happen.
Out there is the key thing. Oh, good. Of course they will.
They will happen. You know, as you're talking, I'm thinking about both as a kid and also as an adult with our son going to the national parks. I mean, talk about a national treasure. Oh. Having those as destinations, especially out west, going from Glacier to Wyoming to Mesa Verde. I mean, these are the trips of a lifetime.
Stunning country. They are. They are. And it makes. You know, we can. I know you all talk a lot about, obviously, a lot about politics and current events, and that's not what we're talking about here. But it makes you understand the country a lot better when you see it. It's, you know, there's that dismissive phrase, flyover country, and frankly, that's our country. And getting to see it is so important. And for all, I mean, I'm not trying to make a stand up and salute here, but you understand where you live a lot better when you actually go and see it and not just read about it.
Let me get James from Westtown to join our conversation. Hi, James. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
How you doing? Yes. I'm on Social Security, so I'm like over the hill like many people. But what I want to do this 4th of July is take my adult children from here down through Virginia and just hit some of the ghettos that we have in this country to show them that we as middle class don't even see these things. And at their age, they should be able to work towards eliminating situations of poverty. So people, like in the middle class, never see this. You know what I mean? To them, they just hear about it, and that's it. But I think if they get a chance to see how people are really living in certain sections of our country, which shouldn't be. You know, we're such a rich country, and when you hear, and I'm a Republican, all right, but when I hear that they want to cut taxes and take it away from the poor, I mean, you know, even Republicans don't want that.
Well, James, that's a really interesting trip that you have planned. Larry, what do you think about that?
I am fascinated. Oh, my goodness. I think planning that could be, well, first of all, I mean, the reality is you don't need to take a trip anywhere to really see that. You just go to a part of your town that you don't go to normally, and you see, you can find it. That said, again, it expands your knowledge of the world. And I think you're going to find interesting things. It's easy to use a phrase, ghetto, and you can see dilapidated housing, but you can also see cultural centers and vibrant communities. And again, it's going to change a stereotype and a perception. I don't know how you would research that. I mean, you could do census tracts, you could go to crime, but I think you're going to find yourself an interesting areas. But I would caution with any trip, you need to mix it up. It can't be all of one thing. You want variety. You want you don't want the same thing over and over because it loses its impact. So sort of, you know, add a little bit of a spice to it. And a good way to do that is, and you can do this with families, you know, with little kids, with adults, is that you take turns planning the day or planning half day, saying, you know, we're really going to go to this. We can go to Dad's ghetto tonight. I mean, today and this afternoon, we can go to a theme park. I mean, I know that sounds silly, but you want to keep everybody engaged, because if it's just one person's trip, it turns into a death march.
Sure. Let me just jump in here, James. Thanks for the call to Radio Times. And that's Larry Bleiberg, and we are talking about road trips in this portion of Radio Times today. And this is Radio Times here on WHYY. Here's an email from Beverly. She says, I'm currently watching my son, his wife, and 8-year-old son live stream on Facebook from their trip to Disney World's Animal Kingdom. I couldn't be there, but this is the next best thing! Exclamation point. You know, as James was calling in, I was also thinking that there are, and you mentioned the fact that you were in the South in Mississippi, Larry, that there are these civil rights road trips that people can take to go to Edmund Pettus Bridge and to go to these various sites where a lot of history took place.
Well, yes, that's actually a interest of mine. I'm based in Birmingham, Alabama, and I have a website, civilrightstravel.com. So I am. With that said, without getting anything more into that, there's a wonderful road trip. A classic road trip is what you described, the national parks in the West. Another is Martin Luther King's Trail, and it's a really easy one to do. You start in Atlanta at
the national at his birthplace at the Ebenezer Baptist Church. It's an easy drive of a couple hours to Montgomery, where you can see the Rosa Parks Center and where King lived. And you can then zip up the road right along where the marchers were for the Selma to Montgomery march and walk across the Pettus Bridge. I once wrote, I did a piece for the L.A. Times, that walking that bridge, I took my son on one of those trips, and I made him get out and walk with me. I thought that was the most beautiful sight in America, because you get to the top of that bridge and you think, what would I do if I looked down this bridge and saw there was a whole phalanx of officers and guard dogs and people with clubs waiting for me? Would I have the guts to keep walking? And I asked my son that. And, you know, both of us said, no, we couldn't do that. But, you know, people did. And the one, and then you can go from there to Birmingham, where I am, where there's the National Park Service just created a monument here just a couple months ago for the Civil Rights Center and where the protest happened. And then the trip finishes with a sad finale to Memphis. It's at like 3-4 hours up to Memphis in the Lorraine Motel, where next year is the 50th anniversary of when King was assassinated there. And that's the site of the best civil rights museum in the country.
You know,
so that's
Larry,
a 3-4 day trip.
Sure. And I got to jump in here only because we have about a minute before I have to say goodbye to you. Do you have a special music track or playlist for when you're traveling the country?
We didn't even talk about music or food. Oh, my goodness. Music is such an important part of it. I mean, it used to be you'd grab your pile of cassettes or CDs. Now you might get a Spotify playlist. But you need to have a soundtrack for your trip. You know, you need to have something to keep it going. I remember I was doing a trip with my brother across Kentucky and West Virginia. And sometime in the middle of the night, we popped in a Johnny Cash's Greatest Hits. And it's a moment I'll never forget, coming over a mountain just at twilight and having Folsom Prison Blues blasting out of the speakers of his truck. You know, it was, and I don't know, it's whenever I hear the song, it takes me back to that trip with my brother, and that's a wonderful thing. So make music part of your trip, for
absolutely.
Sure.
Well, Larry Bleiberg, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Oh, it was a lot of fun. Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. He writes for USA Today and Better Homes and Gardens. Coming up, we've got Kelly Dittmer. We're going to be talking about Kelly Dittmer, I should say, talking about President Trump's tweet.
There's a voice in my head that drives my heel. It's my baby calling, says I need you here. And it's a half past four and I'm shifting gear.
I'm Marty Moscoen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. We do not talk about all of President Trump's tweets, but the ones he sent out yesterday deserve discussion. He wrote, I heard poorly rated at Morning Joe speak badly of me. Don't watch anymore. Then how come low IQ crazy Mika, along with Psycho Joe, came to Mar-a-Lago 3 nights in a row around New Year's Eve and insisted on joining me? She was bleeding badly from a facelift. I said no. The condemnation of the president's tweets was mostly bipartisan, covering the political and ideological spectrum. Here's what Deputy Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders said yesterday defending the president's tweets.
I don't think you can expect someone to be personally attacked day after day, minute by minute, and sit back. Look, the American people elected a fighter. They didn't elect somebody to sit back and do nothing. They knew what they were getting when they voted for Donald Trump, and he won overwhelmingly.
Mika Brzezinski and Joe Scarborough wrote an op-ed in today's Washington Post titled, Donald Trump is Not Well. Candidate Trump had insulted Fox's Megyn Kelly, making mention of blood coming out of her whatever, criticized Carly Fiorina's face, Rosie O'Donnell's appearance, Miss Universe. Well, we asked Kelly Dittmer to join us. She is assistant professor of political science at Rutgers University at the Camden campus. She's also a scholar at the Center for American for American Women and Politics at the Eagleton Institute of Politics. And Kelly, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
And to our listeners, lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes at whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Kelly, I thought long and hard about this first question. Is this what misogyny looks like?
Yeah, I do think this is misogyny because it's a pattern of behavior that we've seen from the president that isn't just a one-time deal, something he said that is out of the ordinary for him. He's repeatedly reacted particularly negatively to women who have criticized him and have sort of questioned his power. And that's what misogyny looks like, right? Trying to undermine or discredit women on the basis of things like their appearance or their emotion when you feel threatened by them, when the power that you have, particularly the power you have as a man, feels threatened. And so even just in those series of tweets, he does criticize Joe Scarborough, but he brings most of his attack on Tamika Brzezinski. And it's something we've seen repeatedly from him in terms of the level of response he gives to women who sort of speak truth to power in his case.
I've heard a number of people say that women working in the White House or women who are part of the Trump administration need to talk to the president, need to really push back very publicly on this. I think Elaine Chao was interviewed and she said, well, he is new to the job. Is it just the responsibility of women to correct the president, or is it a responsibility of everybody?
Yeah, I think you raise a really important point. So I think it is the responsibility of everybody. It's not the job of women to eliminate sexism, just as it isn't the job of people of color to eliminate racism. We all have to be attuned to this and call it out when we see it, and also challenge the folks who are engaging in this sort of behavior. I think that for the women who are standing by him, there is a responsibility to stand up to it, but just as there is for the men who stand around him, and quite frankly, just as there is for the president himself. I think sometimes we spend so much time talking about, even in the last 24 hours, well, where's Melania? Where's Ivanka to speak out on this? But the question is, why isn't the president apologizing, right? And why isn't the president taking back some of the things that he said about women? And again, that's because he thinks it's okay. And he's sort of normalized it in his own behavior for not only the campaign and his presidency, but well before then.
Well, first, Lady Melania Trump, I don't know if she tweeted, but said, or I think her office had a press release yesterday, when you attack him, he will punch back 10 times harder. No matter who you are, a man or a woman, he treats everyone equal. I have Lindsey Graham, who tweeted, Mr. President, your tweet was beneath the office, represents what's wrong with American politics. Lisa Murkowski, stop it. The presidential platform should be used for more than bringing people down. POTUS, do you want to be remembered for your tweets or your accomplishments? And it goes on and on from there. Let me just play a clip from this morning's Morning Joe, and co-host Mika Brzezinski was there with Joe Scarborough responding to Trump's tweets attacking her.
You know, big picture, my father just passed away. My mother had two heart attacks. My daughter just lost a friend. Those are the things I'm really worried about. Those are things that really deeply impact me and, leave me thinking about it at night and hurting and worrying and thinking about the future. The president's tweets, whether they're personally aimed at me or aimed at me in some way, that doesn't bother me one bit. It does worry me about the country. And I know we have Richard Haass with us. He appears to have a fragile, impetuous, childlike ego that we've seen over and over again, especially with women. It's like he can't take it.
I wonder, Kelly, I mean, in some ways, is this a teachable moment, do you think?
For the president or for the country?
For the country. Well, I'm not sure. I mean, this is our president. Yeah. This is how he has certainly operated before he was a candidate, how he operated as a candidate. Sure. And it's clear this is how he operates as president. I'm thinking for the country.
Yeah. No, I think so. I mean, I think that moments like this force some of those even who support the president to think about what they want out of their president in terms of behavior and what types of behavior are acceptable. I think more than anything, that maybe perhaps the teachable piece of this is that you have a president who is in the middle of some major policy issues, right? So there's the healthcare debates that are happening this week. The Senate's, working tirelessly to try to put something through. There's the travel ban that went into effect last night, which otherwise would have been a win for this administration. And he continually distracts away from the things that he says matter to the administration. And so for those who are supporting him, I think perhaps part of this is a reminder of what is the role of the president. Is it to put forward an agenda and policy that will be better for the American people, or is it to respond to cable news hosts, right? That we have to sort of push him and push the office back to focusing on what is best for the country in terms of policy. That is the role and the leadership role that the president has taken in the past.
It's interesting to remember that I think it's about 53% of white women, I should say, voted for Donald Trump. And clearly they accepted the things that he said that were revealed about him as a candidate. I'm thinking of the Access Hollywood tape, some of them calling into the show, some were guests on the show, and they were willing to essentially either overlook or forgive or just, you know, give him a pass on this. Is that a problem, do you think, Kelly?
Yeah, I think it is. You know, I think we saw it with even Sarah Huckabee Sanders yesterday. You know, she said, look, the voters knew what they were getting. And she was right. You know, that we knew this is not something new. This is what voters did allow for and elect. You know, all the types of behavior that you see the president engage in and the types of rhetoric. So, you know, I think it is. The question is, how far is too far? And this tweet is far less than what we saw around the Access Hollywood tapes and some of the other treatment, the way he spoke about those who claimed they were victimized by him. That didn't seem to rattle both his male or female supporters significantly. And so I'm not sure this will, but it is problematic because it normalizes a type of behavior that is not okay and perpetuates gender inequity. One thing I've heard people say, you know, this is the new normal, right? Oh, this is Trump, right? This is Trump's America. But it's not the new normal. It's really the old normal that's just resurrected, right, at the highest level of office, right? So sort of sexist treatment, misogynist treatment of women is nothing new, but that we're allowing it again in the White House and having it be okay that the person who sort of sets the values and is the face of the nation embraces it, that's problematic and of concern to me. And I think you hope that people will push back and realize that what his behavior is doing is not just a couple of tweets, but is showing to the world what our values are and is also distracting again from real important policy discussion.
And by you're saying the sort of old normal / new normal, it's about yeah. women's appearances, but it's also about what we feel entitled to say if there's a powerful woman who criticizes us?
Exactly. I mean, so the idea that you call women crazy when they question you, right, is ask the suffragists about that, right? They were deemed as these crazy women who should be locked up because they wanted to have greater independence and the right to vote. So when you try to discount women as crazy because they have crazy ideas, quote unquote, crazy ideas of empowerment, or that they want to embrace and exercise power, that's an old strategy. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a very old strategy to try to disempower women. So it's not just, you know, Mika Brzezinski, but it's the ways that he's talked about other women. You mentioned some of them before, you know, Megyn Kelly, Carly Fiorina, Hillary Clinton, among others. He's not comfortable when women have pushed back against him. And I should add that we've seen that from some of the members of his administration. You look at Jeff Sessions' testimony a couple of weeks ago when he said to Senator Kamala Harris, you're making me nervous. There's threads of that and sort of shades of that discomfort or disorientation with women in power throughout some of this administration.
Let me get Diana from, looks like, Haverford to join our conversation. Hi, Diana. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. I just wanted to make a comment that I think that the president has successfully, systematically and successfully lowered the bar throughout his campaign and now into the presidency, where the stunning statements that he makes are not surprising. and somehow made legitimate by this continual lowering of the bar, no matter how offensive and, you know, who it is, whether it's men or women, but particularly women.
Even, Diana, under these circumstances where there, you know, he's getting a lot of pushback, and not just from his critics or not just from Democrats, a lot of Republicans, not all of them, but a lot of Republicans are pretty offended by what he did.
Well, until they are do more than be offended, until they say, you know what, you either stop your behavior or we're not going to work with you. This is not acceptable. It's below the office of the presidency, the dignity of the office of the presidency. Until there are consequences, just for any 10-year-old bully, until there are consequences, they don't change their behavior.
I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Kelly, anything you want to add to that?
Well, I think one thing I've tried to reiterate in conversations in the last 24 hours, it's not only below the office of the presidency, right? It's below the sort of tenor of conversation we should be having citizen to citizen. This isn't the type of attack that anybody should weigh against men or women. And so sometimes I also think we have to note the lowering of the bar even for all of us in the way that we talk to each other and react to each other, particularly in political discussions, but even beyond that.
And that's Kelly Dittmar, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. You know, I was thinking, Kelly, and I think other people were as well, that, I mean, if you were a CEO and you said this, I think you probably would be fired. I don't know if you agree with that. I was also thinking about that sort of ridiculous thought experiment that if, for instance, Barack Obama had said this, how would people respond? It's when you substitute either the job or the person in the position of president of the United States and saying these same things. It's just, first of all, it's hard to imagine, but also what would our response be?
Yeah, well, I think we have some examples. If you look at, so what was it on that Uber call a couple of weeks ago when somebody joked about women talking too much and he resigned the next day? So there was, you know, there is accountability for these types of behavior sometimes in corporate America. And I'm glad you raised the Obama example, because the other side of this is that Donald Trump also, even when he gives credit to or praises women, he still often does it on the basis of appearance. When Barack Obama called Kamala Harris, when she was Attorney General of California, attractive, that became a huge news story as, you know, this is sexist, you're degrading her. And he had just, in his comments, said, you know, she's one of the most beautiful attorney generals in the country. He apologized within 24 hours of that comment and said, you know, I value women, I didn't mean it that way, et cetera. The president repeatedly talks about women that way. He said it about Nikki Haley at a cabinet meeting. He, the other day, said it about a reporter from Ireland, called her out for having a nice smile, and therefore the prime minister must love her. He doesn't apologize for that type of behavior. And in fact, we don't call it out as often, though we do. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we sort of see it as something that his modus operandi. So I think we do have those examples for your thought experiment to show that we have reacted differently in the past, and we have begun to sort of accept this style of behavior from this president.
And Kelly, we're almost out of time here, but, you know, I would say if past is prologue, I don't expect an apology from the president of the United States.
I don't think we can expect an apology, but I think what we can hope for is that people continually call this sort of behavior out as inappropriate.
Well, I appreciate you joining us today in Radio Times. We were tracking you down last night to get you on the show. Kelly Dittmar, thanks so much.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Assistant Professor of Political Science at Rutgers University at the Camden campus. She's also a scholar at the Center for American Women and Politics at the Eagleton Institute of Politics. Go to WHYY.org/Radio Times and you can find out much more about the program. In fact, yesterday I posted something on Facebook about the president's tweets. We got an overwhelming response, and you can continue that conversation on our Facebook page. Adam Staniszewski, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Trinae Nuri. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thank you so much for joining us.